AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And right now we are joined by Patrick Koulikan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you give them a follow for the latest in Minnesota news and politics and all of the great journalistic work they do. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today. Always good to have you back on.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So today we have a number of topics we're going to be talking about, including affordable housing and what the Minnesota state legislature might do to try to create more affordable housing projects, at least at the local level, since oftentimes you have local governments sometimes scuttling these projects. We'll get more into that in just a few minutes. We'll also be talking about the Minnesota Supreme Court and how a right-wing group is trying to challenge felon voting rights being restored to Minnesota. That's something that happened last year. And we'll also be talking about how fewer people died on Minnesota roads back in 2023. But first, let's go back and talk about what's happening with affordable housing and this project specifically in Edina, because I think this will kind of give context to what we're talking about. So in the city of Edina, there was this affordable housing project that was going to provide 89 units that was going to be built by this company called Sohelm, which is a Minneapolis-based developer. The project was basically fully funded thanks to help from the Minnesota MFHA, the Minnesota Finance Housing Agency, and initially it appeared that the city of Edina was going to be on board as part of the city's comprehensive plan since the project fit into the comprehensive plan. But then things changed. And now these fully funded units are not going to be built. And that's largely because neighborhood opposition started to mount, as you might expect sometimes when you have affordable housing projects. And that led to the project largely being scuttled thanks to some actions taken by the city that kind of added red tape to it. So, as I'm curious, Patrick, what happened and how did this project end up getting scuttled? Because it seems like a story we often see in Minnesota where an affordable housing project looked like it's going to get greenlit, and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of opposition from citizens and the city backtracks. So walk us through what happened in this Edina project.
Yeah, so cities have a comprehensive plan, and the plan did call for housing there, but the zoning regs had not been updated to be consistent with the plan. So they were going to need a rezoning to build housing on the site. And then some residents, as we so often see, a minority of residents of Edina, but a vocal minority, started to stir up opposition. They got 1,000 people to sign a petition, which of course sounds like a lot, but it's still a very small minority of people who live there, and they opposed the rezoning. And then there was another petition from a nearby townhome association, which called for something called a small area plan, which is like another regulatory regime that would be specific to this portion of Edina. Once that was established, they start this 12 to 18 month process to plan for future development of a multi-acre area that included the proposed site. And the city council said, yeah, we want that too. So once they do that, now your construction timeline is off, and you don't get those federal tax credits that you need to finance the project. And it was basically done. I think that it's a story that's it's so often we've heard it so often that it's kind of almost a cliche when neighbors get riled up and stop a project. In this case, you have a real good indication of what they were against, because originally the developer wanted to do market rate apartments, meaning, you know, probably kind of expensive. This is Edina, after all, expensive apartments. But when interest rates went up and the market conditions changed, they went out and find this financing for affordable apartments. Now all of a sudden, the fine people of Edina were quite concerned about noise, traffic, property values, all the stuff that people usually complain about. And so thankfully, at the legislature this year, they're considering a number of bills that would really override some of these local zoning rules that so effectively keep projects from being built. And I think what Zach, the writer, did here effectively is he says, look, you've got kind of two tracks here, two separate policy issues. One is just affordable housing. We don't have enough of it. We don't build much of it. The other are these land use rules. And, you know, a lot of people have been focusing on that. This legislative session is going to help make it easier for developers to build. But the two are actually related, because often it is those land use rules that are used to prevent the building of affordable housing, you know, subsidized affordable housing. And even if, when they do get it built, all these rules often mean we don't get as much bang for our buck as we could otherwise. So it's just another reason that the legislature ought to be taking a good hard look at these local land use rules and the way in which it has prevented development, not just a market rate housing, but also of affordable housing.
Yeah, I want to get more into what the legislature is proposing and the response that some local cities and local governments are responding to with this. But this is kind of a convenient out that cities can often use. And I'm not just singling out Edina, where they can say, oh, well, this project looks great to bring in all these affordable housing units, but oh, the zoning requirements don't quite line up and it doesn't look like the timeline's going to match up. And they can kind of sort of satisfy both parties with the developer. They can say, well, we wanted these units built, but it just doesn't fit our zoning permits. And then the angered residents, well, they don't get the project built in the first place that they didn't want, which is kind of a good way to squash it. So it's a convenient kind of out for at least the local level to squash these projects. But yeah, the legislature looks like they want to change things in terms of what these local cities can do.
Yeah, they want to stop cities from blocking some denser housing like duplexes and townhomes in neighborhoods everywhere. And then also, if you're near transit stops or commercial areas, you need to allow larger apartment buildings. I mean, these are sensible reforms. There's another constant difficulty for developers is minimum parking requirements. At the same time that we're trying to get people out of their cars, we're also demanding, cities are anyway, these huge minimum parking requirements that drive up the cost of development and prevent more building. They're also considering a rewrite of the state building codes to allow some taller buildings with a single staircase. That has the reason we had required multiple staircases in the past is a safety issue, but they think it can be done safely and it would allow much more efficient apartment construction. And then there's you know, a lot of construction materials that cities will require really for aesthetic reasons, and you know, I think we want beautiful cities. But we also want enough housing, and that's another issue, that's mandate that's been used as a cudgel to prevent development in cities, especially in the metro and especially in the suburbs. So the basic idea here is we're deregulating and giving folks more power to do what they want with their own property. And so that's part of the reason why this has become attractive to Republicans, and is really one of the most, if you love bipartisanship, you'll love this effort, because there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats that have come together on this issue.
Yeah, and that leads me to my next question is to, how are local governments responding to this, and specifically the Minnesota League of Cities? Because oftentimes when I've talked about the Minnesota League of Cities in past when I've been on the radio, usually it's been them opposing Republicans using preemption against local districts. But now, of course, with the DFL in control of the state legislature, it proposes kind of an interesting dynamic, because as I imagine, the Minnesota League of Cities probably is not very much in favor of this becoming law and taking away some of the local control that governments have when it comes to approving these types of affordable housing projects.
Yeah, they hate it. And there's a journalist who pointed out on Twitter recently that a memo from the city administrator in Shakopee to the council members there was really using some alarmist language. He said, local city governments across the state of Minnesota are under siege. And that sounds really extreme. Well, current legislation being considered by state government seeks to strip basic and fundamental controls that cities have used for decades to ensure the viability of their communities and will destroy a city's zoning power. That was particularly interesting to me because Shakopee last year, as the Sahan Journal reported, got caught, really basically got caught with their hand in the cookie jar when the reporter did a public records request and got emails showing that they were really working to prevent an affordable housing complex there in Shakopee. So, you know, the usual response is local control, you know, and they tend to they act as if that sort of ends the argument. And I don't know why it would. There's all kinds of ways in which we don't want local control. You know, if we're going to be hyperbolic about it, you know, we can point to racially segregated zoning that was very common until it was overturned by the Supreme Court. And then even after that, neighborhoods and property owners would put racial covenants on their properties. So just because something is local control doesn't mean it's good or just. And so I hope the legislature is taking a hard look at these reforms.
Well, you can read more about what Zach wrote over at MinnesotaReformer.com, titled Minnesota Lawmakers Aim to Stop Cities from Killing Affordable Housing. It's an interesting read because we have, like so many other states, an affordable housing crisis here in Minnesota, and this could be one way to possibly mitigate that. But as you'll read in the article, there's definitely some opposition. I want to briefly touch on two other stories that you guys were working on over at The Reformer, and this one has to do with this right-wing group that is seeking to basically stop felons from having their voting rights restored. Because what happened last year was that 55,000 Minnesotans who were convicted of a felony and are no longer in prison are allowed to vote while still on parole, probation, or supervised release. Basically, prior to the change that was made back in 2023, felons had to wait until they were off probation, parole, or supervised release and had to pay their fines or restitution. And basically, given that Minnesota has a very lengthy probation sentencing system, that could oftentimes mean years for many convicted felons. So what was happening was that we were going to have Minnesota felon rights restored, but instead we have a challenge from this right-wing group called Minnesota Voters Alliance. And the grounds they're challenging this on are really interesting because to me it kind of sounds like they're splitting hairs, but when it comes to legal language, well, sometimes that's what you have to do. Because what they're arguing about is that the Minnesota legislature, and correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, is that they're arguing that the Minnesota legislature was restoring one right instead of multiple rights. And that's kind of the crux of their argument, saying that, well, you have to restore all of their rights instead of just a single right. So this whole language appears to be splitting hairs, but it is very important with this case of the state legislature.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. You're the lawyer, right? But I just don't know that the court is going to go for it.
I don't. Yeah.
I think because the court itself, if you remember, the Supreme Court ruled that the legislature could prevent people. This is back before the law passed last year, and sort of laid out how the legislature could, if it wanted to, restore people's voting rights. And the legislature, that was just weeks before the legislature did so, and the legislature went on and restored voting rights. So it's the same Supreme Court, more or less. And so I just don't think that they're going to react very well to this kind of, as I called it, grammar neener. Yeah, I think that the court said, here's how you would restore voting rights, and the legislature did it. And I'd be very surprised if the court were to overturn the legislature's ability to do that. Also, I mean, you know, just from a policy standpoint, when people get out of prison, when you want them to really reintegrate into society, one of the ways that is helpful is if they are civically active. I mean, it's intuitively, it makes sense, and I think it's been shown to be true. And so we want people to get engaged, and so it's good policy. You know, why on earth would this group want to prevent these 55,000 people, or what, approximately, get back into civic life? And I think it's to me, it's pretty obvious.
Yes.
It's because they're afraid that those are 55,000 Democratic votes.
Yep, pretty much hit the nail on the head right there. And from what we're seeing so far, and you can read more in Michelle's article over at MinnesotaReformer.com, it does sound like the justices are rather skeptical about some of these arguments from that right-wing group. But make sure you go read more about that over at MinnesotaReformer.com. And briefly, want to touch on one more thing you guys worked on over at The Reformer, and that has to do with what Christopher Ingram wrote, talking about how fewer people died on Minnesota roads in 2023, which sometimes kind of flies in the face of what we often hear from other media outlets saying, well, Minnesota's roads are as dangerous as ever. Well, the data shows that's not necessarily the case, no matter how you measure it. Looking at highway deaths, they've receded after kind of spiking during the pandemic. Highway deaths are at near record lows comparing decade after decade. In fact, they're way down looking at the 2020s, while the highway death rate has fallen by nearly 90%. So I'm curious, did anything jump out at you looking at what Christopher was able to research? Because I'm glad he's able to put together these numbers, because it kind of sometimes flies in the face of the narrative we often hear with what's happening with Minnesota roads.
Yeah, I think we were all a little frightened that once or twice on the roads the last couple of years. But what to me, this is such a great story, because when you look at the historical sweep, what it really shows is a huge public policy success. And I don't think we talk about that enough. And what you see here in this one of his charts is this, I mean, 1,000 people, I think it was per million vehicle miles. Deaths in Minnesota vehicle accidents.
Yeah, yeah.
You had 1,000 people dying, around in 1970. And of course, far fewer people driving and vehicle miles traveled in those days. And what happened around these years? Well, Ralph Nader came on the scene, and he really forced through the regulatory and legislative process a lot of safety improvements on the automobile industry, and it worked. We're a lot safer on the roads. You're much less likely to get hurt or die in a crash. The cars are safer much safer. And hopefully we're drinking and driving a lot less as well. And that's due to the better enforcement that took place starting, I think, in the 70s. So it's a good news story when you look at the historical sweep. And I think it really flies in the face of this this kind of notion that, it doesn't matter what we do, just throw up our hands. When in fact, if you put the right policies in place, you put the right laws and regulations in place, you can have a lot of success in making something, a common human activity, safer.
Yeah, I encourage you to check out that chart. Yeah, it's highway deaths near record lows, which does show the deaths in Minnesota vehicles from 1950 to 2023. And it is just insane how in 1970, we were up near 1,000 deaths per 1 million, and now it's down to about 400, which is a near record low level. And as you said, many of those drops started happening as we started changing our policy, whether it was drinking and driving, seatbelt policy, and so forth. So yeah, I think it does show a great sign that we can have policy success when you, commit to those types of policies. But you can read more about that with Christopher wrote on that data over at MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Again, MinnesotaReformer.com. Hey, as always, thanks for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.